Chapter 24. The more sure, the more glorious, the more magnificent the prize. From wonder to wonder, his encouragement led the impatient listener. A strange nature bloomed before him, giant streams promised him success, gardens of hidden treasures opened to his view. All this, so vividly described, seemed to gain a new witchery from his glowing fancy. It seems to me that this situation is new in romance. I feel sure it has not been attempted before. Military celebrities have been disguised and set at lowly occupations for dramatic effect, but I think McClintock is the first to send one of them to school. Thus, in this book, you pass from wonder to wonder, through gardens of hidden treasure, where giant streams bloom before you, and behind you, and all around, and you feel as happy, and groggy, and satisfied with your quart of mixed metaphor aboard as you would, if it had been mixed in a sample room and delivered from a jug. Now we come upon some more McClintockian surprise, a sweetheart who has sprung upon us without any preparation, along with a name for her which is even a little more of a surprise than she herself is. In 1842 he entered the class, and made rapid progress in the English and Latin departments. Indeed, he continued advancing with such rapidity that he was like to become the first in his class, and made such unexpected progress, and was so studious, that he had almost forgotten the pictured saint of his affections. The fresh wreaths of the pine and cypress had waited anxiously to drop once more the dews of heaven upon the heads of those who had so often poured forth the tender emotions of their souls under its boughs. He was aware of the pleasure that he had seen there. So one evening, as he was returning from his reading, he concluded he would pay a visit to this enchanting spot. Little did he think of witnessing a shadow of his former happiness, though no doubt he wished it might be so. He continued sauntering by the roadside, meditating on the past. The nearer he approached the spot, the more anxious he became. At that moment a tall female figure flitted across his path, with a bunch of roses in her hand. Her countenance showed uncommon vivacity, with a resolute spirit. Her ivory teeth already appeared as she smiled beautifully, promenading while her ringlets of hair dangled unconsciously around her snowy neck. Nothing was wanting to complete her beauty. The tinge of the rose was in full bloom upon her cheek. The charms of sensibility and tenderness were always her associates. In Ambulinia's bosom dwelt a noble soul, one that never faded, one that never was conquered. Ambulinia. It can hardly be matched in fiction. The full name is Ambulinia Valier. Marriage will presently round it out and perfect it. Then it will be Mrs. Ambulinia Valier Alfonso. It takes the chromo. Her heart yielded to no feeling, but the love of Alfonso, on whom she gazed with intense delight, and to whom she felt herself more closely bound, because he sought the hand of no other. Alfonso was roused from his apparent reverie. His books no longer were his inseparable companions, his thoughts arrayed themselves to encourage him to the field of victory. He endeavored to speak to his supposed Ambulinia, but his speech appeared not in words. No, his effort was a stream of fire that kindled his soul into a flame of admiration, and carried his senses away captive. Ambulinia had disappeared, to make him more mindful of his duty. As she walked speedily away through the piney woods, she calmly echoed, "Oh, Alfonso, thou wilt now look from thy sunbeams. Thou shalt now walk in a new path, perhaps thy way leads through darkness. But fear not, the stars foretell happiness." To McClintock that jingling jumble of fine words meant something, no doubt, or seemed to mean something, but it is useless for us to try to divine what it was. Ambulinia comes we don't know whence, nor why, she mysteriously intimates we don't know what, and then she goes echoing away we don't know whither, and down comes the curtain. McClintock's art is subtle, McClintock's art is deep. Not many days afterward, as surrounded by fragrant flowers she sat one evening at twilight, who enjoy the cool breeze that whispered notes of melody along the distant groves, the little birds perched on every side, as if to watch the movements of their new visitor. The bells were tolling when Alfonso silently stole along by the wildwood flowers, holding in his hand his favorite instrument of music, his eye continually searching for Ambulinia, who hardly seemed to perceive him, as she played carelessly with the songsters that hopped from branch to branch. Nothing could be more striking than the difference between the two. Nature seemed to have given the more tender soul to Alfonso, and the stronger and more courageous to Ambulinia. A deep feeling spoke from the eyes of Alfonso, such a feeling as can only be expressed by those who are blessed as admirers, and by those who are able to return the same with sincerity of heart. He was a few years older than Ambulinia. She had turned a little into her 17th. He had almost grown up in the Cherokee country, with the same equal proportions as one of the natives. But little intimacy had existed between them until the year 41, because the youth felt that the character of such a lovely girl was too exalted to inspire any other feeling than that of quiet reverence. But as lovers will not always be insulted, at all times, and under all circumstances, by the frowns and cold looks of crabbed old age, which should continually reflect dignity upon those around, and treat the unfortunate as well as the fortunate with a graceful mien, he continued to use diligence and perseverance. All this lighted a spark in his heart that changed his whole character, and like the unyielding deity that follows the storm to check its rage in the forest, he resolves for the first time to shake off his embarrassment and return where he had before only worshipped. At last we begin to get the major's measure. We are able to put this and that casual fact together, and build the man up before our eyes, and look at him. And after we have got him built, we find him worth the trouble. By the above comparison between his age and Ambulinia's, we guess the war-worn veteran to be 22, and the other facts stand thus. He had grown up in the Cherokee country with the same equal proportions as one of the natives. How flowing and graceful the language, and yet how tantalizing as to meaning. He had been turned adrift by his father, to whom he had been omwad of a dutiful son. He wandered in distant lands, came back frequently o the scenes of his boyhood, almost destitute of many of the comforts of life, in order to get into the presence of his father's winter-worn locks, and spread a humid veil of darkness around his expectations. But he was always promptly sent back to the cold charity of the combat again. He learned to play the fiddle, and made a name for himself in that line. He had dwelt among the wild tribes. He had philosophized about the despoilers of the kingdoms of the earth, and found out the cunning creature that they refer their differences to the learned for settlement. He had achieved a vast fame as a military chieftain, the Achilles of the Florida campaigns, and then had got him a spelling book and started to school. He had fallen in love with Ambulinia Valier while she was teething, but had kept it to himself a while, out of the reverential awe which he felt for the child. But now at last, like the unyielding deity who follows the storm to check its rage in the forest, he resolves to shake off his embarrassment, and to return where, before he had only worshipped. The major, indeed, has made up his mind to rise up and shake his faculties together, and to see if he can't do that thing himself. This is not clear, but no matter about that. There stands the hero, compact and visible, and he is no mean structure, considering that his creator had never structure, considering that his creator had never created anything before, and hadn't anything but racks and wind to build with this time. It seems to me that no one can contemplate this odd creature, this quaint and curious blatherskite, without admiring McClintock, or, at any rate, loving him and feeling grateful to him. For McClintock made him, he gave him to us. Without McClintock we could not have had him, and would now be poor. But we must come to the feast again. Here is a courtship scene, down there in the romantic glades among the raccoons, alligators, and things that has merit, peculiar literary merit. See how Achilles woos. Dwell upon the second sentence, particularly the close of it, and the beginning of the third. Never mind the new personage, Leos, who is intruded upon us unheralded and unexplained. That is McClintock's way. It is his habit. It is a part of his genius. He cannot help it. He never interrupts the rush of his narrative to make introductions. It could not escape Ambulinia's penetrating eye that he sought an interview with her, which he has anxiously avoided, and assumed a more distant calmness than before, seemingly to destroy all hope. After many efforts and struggles with his own person, with timid steps the major approached the damsel, with the same caution as he would have done in a field of battle. "Addie Ambulinia," said he, trembling, "I have long desired a moment like this. I dare not let it escape. I fear the consequences, yet I hope your indulgence will at least hear my petition. Can you not anticipate what I would say, and what I am about to express? Will not you, like Minerva, who sprung from the brain of Jupiter, release me from thy winding chains, or cure me a no more, Alfonso?" answered Ambulinia, with a serious look, raising her hand, as if she intended to swear eternal hatred against the whole world. "Another lady in my place would have perhaps answered your question in bitter coldness. I know not the little arts of my sex. I care but little for the vanity of those who would chide me, and am unwilling as well as ashamed to be guilty of anything that would lead you to think all is not gold that glitters. So be no rash in your resolution. It is better to repent now, than to do it in a more solemn hour. Yes, I know what you would say. I know you have a costly gift for me, the noblest that man can make your heart. You should not offer it to one so unworthy. Heaven, you know, has allowed my father's house to be made a house of solitude, a home of silent obedience, which my parents say is more to be admired than big names and high-sounding titles. Notwithstanding all this, let me speak the emotions of an honest heart. Allow me to say in the fullness of my hopes that I anticipate better days. The bird may stretch its wings toward the sun, which it can never reach, and flowers of the field appear to ascend in the same direction, because they cannot do otherwise. But man confides his complaints to the saints, in whom he believes, for in their abodes of light they know no more sorrow. From your confession and indicative looks, I must be that person. If so, deceive not yourself. Alfonso replied, "Pardon me, my dear madam, for my frankness. I have loved you from my earliest days. Everything grand and beautiful hath borne the image of Ambulinia. While precipices on every hand surrounded me, your guardian angel stood and beckoned me away from the deep abyss. In every trial, in every misfortune, I have met with your helping hand. Yet I never dreamed or dared to cherish thy love, till a voice impaired with age encouraged the cause, and declared they who acquired thy favor should win a victory. I saw how Leos worshipped thee. I felt my own unworthiness. I began to know jealously, a strong guest indeed, in my bosom, yet I could see, if I gained your admiration, Leos was to be my rival. I was aware that he had the influence of your parents, and the wealth of a deceased relative, which is too often mistaken for permanent and regular tranquility. Yet I have determined by your permission to beg an interest in your prayers, to ask you to animate my drooping spirits by your smiles and your winning looks. For if you but speak, I shall be conqueror, my enemies shall stagger like Olympus shakes. And though earth and sea may tremble, and the charioteer of the sun may forget his dashing steed, yet I am assured that it is only to arm me with divine weapons which will enable me to complete my long-tried intention." "Return to yourself, Alfonso," said Ambulinia, pleasantly. "Dream of vision has disturbed your intellect. You are above the atmosphere, dwelling in the celestial regions. Nothing is there that urges or hinders, nothing that brings discord into our present litigation. I entreat you to condescend a little, and be a man, and forget it all. When Homer describes the battle of the gods, and noblemen fighting with giants and dragons, they represent under this image our struggles with the delusions of our passions. You have exalted me, an unhappy girl, to the skies. You have called me a saint, and portrayed in your imagination an angel in human form. Let her remain such to you, let her continue to be as you have supposed, and be assured that she will consider a share in your esteem as her highest treasure. Think not that I would allure you from the path in which your conscience leads you, for you know I respect the conscience of others, as I would die for my own. Alfonso, if I am worthy of thy love, let such conversation never again pass between us. Go, seek a nobler theme, we will seek it in the stream of time, as the sunset in the Tigris. As she spake these words she grasped the hand of Alfonso, saying at the same time, peace and prosperity attend you, my hero, be up and doing. Closing her remarks with this expression, she walked slowly away, leaving Alfonso astonished and amazed. He ventured not to follow or detain her. Here he stood alone, gazing at the stars. Confounded as he was, here he stood. Yes, there he stood. There seems to be no doubt about that. Nearly half of this delirious story has now been delivered to the reader. It seems a pity to reduce the other half to a cold synopsis. Pity, it is more than a pity, it is a crime, for to synopsize McClintock is to reduce a sky-flushing conflagration to dull embers, it is to reduce barbaric splendor to ragged poverty. McClintock never wrote a line that was not precious. He never wrote one that could be spared. He never framed one from which a word could be removed without damage. Every sentence that this master has produced may be likened to a perfect set of teeth, white, uniform, beautiful. If you pull one, the charm is gone. Still, it is now necessary to begin to pull, and to keep it up, for lack of space requires us to synopsize. We left Alfonso standing there amazed. At what, we do not know. Not at the girl's speech. No. We ourselves should have been amazed at it, of course, for none of us has ever heard anything resembling it. But Alfonso was used to speeches made up of noise and vacancy, and could listen to them with undaunted mind like the topmost topaz of an ancient tower. He was used to making them himself. He but let it go, it cannot be guessed out. We shall never know what it was that astonished him. He stood there a while. Then he said, alas, am I now grief's disappointed son at last? He did not stop to examine his mind, and to try to find out what he probably meant by that, because, for one reason, a mixture of ambition and greatness of soul moved upon his young heart, and started him for the village. He resumed his bench in school, and reasonably progressed in his education. His heart was heavy, but he went into society, and sought surcease of sorrow in its light distractions. He made himself popular with his violin, which seemed to have a thousand chords more symphonious than the muses of Apollo, and more enchanting than the ghost of the hills. This is obscure, but let it go. During this interval Leos did some unencouraged courting, but at last, choked by his undertaking, he desisted. Presently, Alfonso again wends his way to the stately walls and new-built village. He goes to the house of his beloved. She opens the door herself. To my surprise, for Ambulinia's heart had still seemed free at the time of their last interview, love beamed from the girl's eyes. One sees that Alfonso was surprised too, for when he caught that light, a halo of smothered shouts ran through every vein. A neat figure, a very neat figure, indeed. Then he kissed her. The scene was overwhelming. They went into the parlor. The girl said it was safe, for her parents were abed, and would never know. Then we have this fine picture flung upon the canvas with hardly an effort, as you will notice. Advancing toward him, she gave a bright display of her rosy neck, and from her head the ambrosial locks breathed divine fragrance. Her robe hung waving to his view, while she stood like a goddess confessed before him. There is nothing of interest in the couple's interview. Now at this point the girl invites Alfonso to a village show, where jealousy is the motive of the play, for she wants to teach him a wholesome lesson. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.